Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu.
Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Lots of shark talk this summer. Great whites off California and the East Coast. TV news helicopters buzzing the beaches. Mischievous swimmers humming the tune from Jaws. But some relatively simple questions about these great predators still don't have clear answers. Like, how many great whites are there? How long do they live? Is their population rebounding or dwindling? A new project is aimed at trying to answer these big questions using shark snapshots from tourists, boaters, surfers around the globe, from anyone who's on the water and spots a fin. This hour, On Point, tracking and studying great white sharks with your photos. You can join the conversation. What's your great white shark story? Would you share your pics to help get a global count? Could you hold the camera steady enough to do it? You can also comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me first today from Lausanne, Switzerland, is Michael Scholl, marine biologist, photographer, and expert on great white sharks. He's the founder and director of the White Shark Trust. His 10 years' worth of shark photos of over 1,500 individual great whites form the basis of a new computer database that one day will help scientists, he hopes, track and study great whites. I should say you can see a gallery of samples of his fin shots at our website, onpointradio.org, and it's pretty cool. Michael Scholl, welcome to On Point. Thanks for being here.
Hi, Tom. It's good to be on your show. Thank you.
So what are you trying to do? We heard about this just last week and we're fascinated. You want people to take pictures of any great white they see anywhere and do what?
Well, one of the things you need to be able to do when you study a population, especially of wild animals, is you need to be able to recognize the individuals. And, you know, many scientists use tags and so on. But the problem with tags is, especially in the marine environment, they get overgrown with algae very quickly and they fall off. So, you know, cetacean scientists working with dolphins and whales have been taking pictures to recognize their animals for decades. So that's the system that I've developed. So basically, just taking the picture of a dorsal fin is just like a fingerprint for us. So it allows us to recognize the individual sharks.
Now, I'm looking here at a couple of dozen of fins from your collection of photographs. They can all make the hair on the back of your neck stand up, especially if you're in the water. But is it, you know, I mean, they look different, but pretty similar. A lot of them are beat up. They look like they've been through some tough fights or propeller engagements here. But is it as distinctive as a fingerprint, a great white shark's fin?
It's different in a way that we're born with a fingerprint and it remains with us our whole life. Whereas with sharks, it's something that comes from the environment. So it's basically, I would compare it to a flag in the wind. The back edge of the trailing edge of a flag basically frays off and you've got those little marks that appear. Mm-hmm. So the same thing with the sharks. The water will basically slowly abrade the back end of that fin and making little notches and patterns that are easily recognizable.
So it's the wear and tear, the kind of notches on the back of their fin that are the main identifier here.
Yeah, mainly. There's some other identification, like some birthmarks on the side of the fin that can also help. And obviously encounters with other sharks or with seals or with boat propellers can make very clear markings also.
So by that, presumably, the older the shark is, the more identifying features there are going to be. How long do sharks live?
I wish I knew. I wish I knew. Nobody really knows how long those white sharks live. Estimates range from 30 years to 100 years. So unfortunately, that's basically just shows how little we know about those animals. We really don't even know the basic things.
Now, what you're looking at here is a meeting of all these photographs and computer technology, which I guess you're hoping will be able to have a software that would sort through all these photographs taken by people all over the place and what, identify the number of distinct individual great white sharks on the planet?
The idea is just the same as when you tag animals. You basically tag a certain number of individuals in a population, and then you know, a few days later or a few weeks later, you do another sample of the population, and you get a percentage of how many have already been tagged compared to how many are not tagged. And from that, you can do sophisticated models and come up with estimates of how big that population actually is.
I'm still trying to think about how this would work. When you take photos of great white sharks, you've done a lot of it. Do you typically get just their fin? How do you know it's a great white fin as opposed to some other kind of shark? And for your purposes, does it have to be a perfect profile shot of the fin, or can it be a you know, general shot of the shark alongside somebody's boat, let's say?
The advantage with white sharks is that they're very active at the surface. So, and that's the one part of the animal that really breaks the surface most often. So it's fairly easy actually to get a picture of the dorsal fin. And those sharks are really not afraid of boats. So if they come up to, they often come within a few meters. So, but you need a good shot from the side to get that trailing edge really clear.
And who are you hoping might provide most of these shots? I mean, lots of fishermen are no fans of sharks, so they may see plenty. I mean, who are you hoping will be out there with their digital cameras and the, you know, a cool hand to take these photos?
Well, I mean, in the world, there's about a dozen scientists who work in the field every day. So with white sharks. So obviously that's I would say the core where the database will be growing. But aside from the scientists, you have hundreds of tourists that go and see and dive with white sharks. Not really off the coast of California because it's outlawed, but in Australia, in New Zealand, in South Africa mainly,
it's big business.
In Mexico,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It's big business. Yeah, and you have hundreds of those tourists that go out and, you know, might as well use their camera equipment and their resources to take the pictures. They take pictures anyway, so might as well use them for something.
Michael Scholl is with us from Lausanne, Switzerland. He's looking at putting together a huge database of great white shark photos of their fins from around the world to get a sense of what's going on with this fascinating population. Let's get a call from Bellbuckle, Tennessee. James, you're on the air with Michael Scholl in Switzerland.
Hey, Tom. I've got a question. If I understand you correctly, you identify specimens by wear and tear on the dorsal fin,
mm-hmm.
and it seems to me that it might be difficult to avoid, you know, misidentifying a specimen more than once as additional wear, you know, happens to their dorsal fin. How do you prevent that?
Michael Scholl.
Well, there's really no way to avoid that. I guess the best way is to you know, if it's an ongoing research, you get those sharks often enough that you can track those little changes. I mean, the longest I've had sharks was 7 years. One shark that I could follow year after year, and I would say maybe when they're young, when the dorsal fin is very thin and maybe a bit more fragile, the main markings will appear in the first few years. Once the shark has grown to a certain, you know, 10 feet and above, the dorsal fin has become much thicker and tougher, and the markings really don't change that much. Obviously, I mean, once I had a shark that, you know, he somehow, probably from a boat propeller,
mm-hmm.
lost half of its fin, so then it becomes much more complicated. But I would say over 90% of the sharks are fairly easily recognizable.
So it may not be a perfect method of ID, but this isn't a criminal court after all. It's to get a pretty good idea of what the population is and what it's doing. But James, thanks. It's a good question. Thanks for your call. Sarah in Boston. Sarah, you're on the air with Michael Scholl.
Hi, Tom. I was just wondering if I were to have photos of great white sharks, how I could contribute them to this project.
Do you have some, Sarah?
Yeah, I went shark cage diving in Cape Town, South Africa.
How long ago?
I guess it was about 2 years now.
And you paid money to go down in a cage and have great white sharks snap at you?
Yeah, I did. I paid a lot of money.
Are you cuckoo?
No, it was really fun.
Did you stand down there while they were coming at you, taking their pictures? Were you cool enough to do that?
Oh, yeah, I was definitely cool enough to do that. It was fun. One slammed into the cage.
Wow. Okay. Everybody's definition of fun is different, I guess. But Michael Scholl, Sarah's got photos. You've got the project. Are you prepared at this point to start accepting people's photos or not?
There are people who send me pictures, and I basically keep them safely aside. But basically, what we're trying to do with the project is to develop this software that will do this automatically. Because the problem I have is that I've got over 8,000 entries and hundreds of thousands of pictures. And when you have to compare one image with all those thousands of images, it becomes very complicated. So the idea now with the project at the moment is to really develop this software that will do this, you know, in a automated way, just like what you see on TV shows. That's the idea. So, but yeah, I would love to see her pictures. So,
where can she send them? And do you have a website set up already for people to send photos to?
No, I've got my old website when I was still doing the research in South Africa. But she can definitely send them there. So, can I give the
yes? By all means, by all means.
Okay, it's info@whiteshark.org.
info@whiteshark.org. We'll put that up at our website as well, and presumably one day you'll have even a more robust site for people to file their photos at, Michael.
Definitely. No, the idea is really to have my dream is to have a site where people can log on, put in their pictures, and hopefully within a few seconds or minutes get an answer back saying, you know, your shark was sighted on such a date, in such a place, for example, or, you know, that would be amazing. I think from a conservation and education point of view, it would be fantastic also, because it would really get the people a more personal touch with those sharks.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about counting sharks, great white sharks, and a new campaign to photograph and track their numbers worldwide by getting photos of their fins. Michael Scholl is putting it together. He joins us today from Lausanne, Switzerland. He is founder and director of the White Shark Trust. Lots of great white sightings off the East Coast this summer, prompting beach closings, lots of news coverage. Here's a New England Cable News report about one shark that recently, just last week, made its way into a Massachusetts Cape Cod harbor on Thursday.
Another shark alert on Cape Cod this morning, but this time a 14-foot great white reportedly made its way into Chatham Harbor. That's creating quite a stir. John Maroney joins us live from Chatham with the latest. John, you're going to need a bigger boat?
Going to need a bigger boat. The question, famous quote from Jaws right there. Everybody's talking about them. We're talking about counting them and what's going on with this population globally. Right now from Marin County, California, John McCosker joins us. He's senior scientist and chair of the Department of Aquatic Biology at the California Academy of Sciences, one of the world's foremost experts on great white sharks. He's done a lot of research on human-shark interaction, including the reasons behind attacks when they come. John McCosker, thanks very much for being with us.
My pleasure, Tom. Nice to talk with you.
There's been a lot of tagging going on for a long time on the East Coast, in California, on the West Coast. What do you think of this idea of putting together a database of fin photos, as it were?
Oh, it's a very good idea. There are many ways to tag sharks. There has been tagging going on, but most recently, the extremely sophisticated electronic tagging, a lot more complicated than what Michael is doing, a lot more expensive than what Michael is doing, is also telling us lots of extraordinary stories about what these animals are doing on a moment-by-moment basis for months at a time.
Well, we want to get a feeling for that, but let's start, if we can, just with populations. I mean, I'm looking at a story here from The Independent in London from earlier this year, John, that says the number of great white sharks in the world may have fallen below the number of tigers. And this is at a point where the estimated number of tigers in the wild was just 3,500. Is it possible that there are that few great white sharks?
Entirely possible. I don't think there are ever a great number of white sharks in the world. The matter is that they are top-level predators, and as such, at the top of the food web, top of the food pyramid, some people might say, you have to have a large population of food items in support of them, and because the seals and sea lions, upon which they fed for so many years, have disappeared worldwide and are beginning to make a modest comeback in a few small areas, there just isn't that much for them to eat.
So tell us
What do we know about great white sharks? I'm reading here. It seems kind of amazing when everything seems to be known, but they've never been witnessed by humans mating or birthing. Can that be true?
It is true, unless someone has seen it and not told us, and I can't imagine that. I think that the matter of white sharks is extraordinary because there's been a doubling time of information about them. I wrote a book with Richard Ellis, published by Stanford, called Great White Shark, and when I did it, in 1989, we didn't know that much about it. Now you could quadruple the size of that book and still not include all of the recent studies and information that we've learned. We haven't seen where they mate. We haven't seen where they birth. But we do know quite a bit about their biology. We're learning more about how fast they grow, in particular because white sharks have been kept alive in the Monterey Bay Aquarium in California, which was an amazing success on their behalf. Many aquariums have tried worldwide to keep them alive. They succeeded. And in doing so, they had some surprising discoveries. How much they feed, how often they feed, and how quickly they grow. They seem to grow much faster than we realize. And they're born at about 4 to 5 foot in length. I mean, that's a big shark.
Yes, it is already.
Yeah, and the largest one yet captured was estimated to be about 20 to 21 foot, about 3 tons or more. It's a very big fish. How long does it take to get that large? Mm-hmm. Estimates more like 25 to 30 years rather than 100 years. Still, that's a long-lived animal in terms of the marine ecosystem.
I'm reading they don't even become sexually reproductive until perhaps they're teens. Is that possible?
Yep.
Which would suggest it quite a long life, I guess.
It suggests that, but even more frighteningly, if you are fond of sharks or at least appreciate their importance to the ecosystem, unless they have a chance to get that large, they won't reproduce. And that's the trouble with shark fisheries everywhere. The problem is that we're catching them before they are even able to reproduce. Remember that there's, you know, nearly 400 different species of sharks in the
mm-hmm.
world, of sharks, different kinds of sharks. And, oh, 3, maybe 4 of them are involved in unprovoked attacks on human beings. So you said, you know, shark populations are a danger. You mentioned that a moment ago. I'd prefer to say that shark populations are endangered. Sharks are mm-hmm. disappearing worldwide because of the human behavior of killing them, cutting their fins off to make shark fin soup. There was a time when we estimate 100 million sharks a year are being slaughtered. Cut the fins off, throw
Holy
the shark
moly.
Away, let this writhing carcass go down and sink to the bottom of the mm-hmm. ocean. So that we can make this soup, and compare that to a dozen human shark interactions resulting in human fatalities. I mean, in perspective, I read
unbelievable.
I read the paper this morning, and 1,600 people have died in Pakistan in floods. Yet, had there been a white shark attack in California, it would have been on the front page and pushed Pakistan to the middle of the paper.
Yeah, as rare as those. I mean, I'm reading here 8 fatalities attributed to white sharks off California going all the way back to 1926.
Yes, it's quite extraordinary when you realize. I mean, I would
50 or 100 million a year slaughtered, though.
Wow. And actually, the number is less than that now because there aren't that many sharks left. There are only about 70 million a year now being slaughtered.
Are great whites as vulnerable as any other shark to that shark's fin harvest slaughter?
Yes, they are, and their fin is worth considerably more. At one time, shark fins were worth more. In recent years, some kinds of shark fins were more than dried cocaine, dried shark fin.
Popular in China, and the Chinese, of course, more and more able to really pay. We've got a lot of listeners who want to join us. John McCosker in Marin County, California, and Michael Scholl in Lausanne, Switzerland. Let's go to them. Sandy in Woods Hole, Massachusetts. No small marine biology location itself. Hi, Sandy. Mm-hmm. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks. I am a fish biologist, but I don't work with sharks. So I'm wondering whether the study you're doing will be able to get at the range and the migratory patterns.
Great question. We'll put it to both. Michael Scholl, first to you. If you can put together your database of fins, what do you hope to learn about the range and migratory patterns of great whites?
Well, the idea, the hope is that indeed it would help in the migratory patterns. I mean, if you've heard about the white shark Nicole, she was actually tagged with one of those satellite tags that John was mentioning before, and she swam from, she was tracked from South Africa to Australia, and then the tag detached itself from the shark, so there was no way to really know where the shark was going anymore. And 6 months later, I saw her back in South Africa. So in a way, hopefully if we get enough people collaborating and sending in pictures, we'll get a clearer picture of what they're doing and where they're going to.
John McCosker, what do we already know about great white shark range and migration patterns?
Michael's absolutely right. The discovery of Nicole going from Australia to South Africa was really quite extraordinary.
How long did it take?
I think it took about 6 months, and we now know that there are sharks that leave California every year and head out to Hawaii in return. But they're in deep water much of the time, and the sea is vast, and there isn't somebody with a camera over most of that area.
Mm-hmm.
So we don't know at what depth they are swimming or how long it takes them, but we do have an idea with a few of these electronic tags that Michael mentioned that are coming to the surface and telling us quite a bit about it. We know that there are now populations of white sharks that are genetically different. That is, your population in the Atlantic differs from the Eastern Pacific, differs from the Southern Ocean, but we don't know if they are different species or just not interbreeding populations. We do know that white sharks live as far north as Alaska, and with global climate change, their food is moving towards the poles, and probably so are the white sharks.
Are they territorial, or do they migrate? Do they range globally, a single shark? Or do those different subspecies you're talking about have, you know, turf?
At this point, we presume they don't that range globally. They don't go from the Northern Ocean across the equator to the Southern Ocean.
Mm-hmm.
But there are populations that have a apparently migratory pattern, whether every individual does every year, every other year, not clear yet. We don't know.
Let's go to David in Providence, Rhode Island. David, you're on the air.
Hi there. Hi, Tom. And
hi,
Michael and John. I was curious, in particular, hearing about the project with regard to the fin. I'm actually a neuroscientist, and I study how we recognize things, how we recognize objects and faces and so forth. And I was wondering whether Michael, in the course of collecting all these pictures of the fins, has come to recognize them. You referred to these like fingerprints, which people are very, it's very difficult to recognize a fingerprint from a snapshot, but a face, of course, you recognize immediately. And I was just curious as to whether he has grown to sort of change his perceptual system and recognizes a fin right away, or he has to study it and kind of say, oh, well, maybe that's, you know, shark X or shark Y.
Oh, that's very interesting. Michael Scholl, the neuroscientist, question, do you recognize a shark fin the way people might recognize a human face?
Yeah, I would say so. I've grown, learned, well, not every shark, obviously, but I mean, there's probably like 200 that I could identify every time. And it, you know, when I was watching a shark documentary that was filmed in South Africa, I would go, oh, I know this one. So, yeah, I mean, to me, that became very familiar.
That's amazing. And just by the notches and the form, I should say again, there's a wonderful little gallery, just a sample of the hundreds and hundreds that Michael has photographed at our website, onpointradio.org. And you get a sense right there for how one might come to really recognize these things. I mean, some of them really lopped off and beat up. What do most of the notches on the fins come from? Is it from fighting or interaction with boats? Or do you know, Michael?
I would say most of them are just, you know, weak spots maybe at birth, and those weak spots basically kind of, abrade. And that's, I mean, I think most of those markings are natural, basically. There are some, obviously, on those pictures, I put those pictures together because they kind of show a wide range, and they're the most distinctive ones. And yeah, some of those have, you know, probably come from interactions with other animals such as seals or other sharks or boats, unfortunately.
Let's go to Hatteras, North Carolina. Oh, that's marine country. Dave, you're on the air. Hi, Dave.
Hi, Tom. Hey, I am an active scuba diver here in Hatteras, and we dive with a wide range of sharks all the time, and great white shark sightings are rather rare. But my question is, has this technique ever been attempted with other species of shark, and would it help identify the sand tiger sharks as an individual species? That's our most common coastal shark that we see.
Thanks for the question, Dave. John McCosker, when you think about identifying, tracking, you know, keeping tabs on populations going forward, you know, what's the range of techniques you expect to be put into play?
as Michael has pointed out, the white shark is amongst the few sharks that is at the surface. We occasionally see basking sharks or thresher sharks, but a sand tiger shark probably rarely, if ever, comes to the surface. So that could only be tagged by someone underwater using a spear gun or swimming alongside of it and then jabbing it with a small tag that could be attached to the shark, which then, as Michael said, will be overgrown with algae and other matters. So it isn't easy. Another way to tag sharks, of course, is to catch them hook and line, implant a tag, measure it, release it. But that stresses the animal, and in order to see it again, count the numbers on the side of its tag, you have to be underwater with it, and that really takes a lot of luck. So in the case of shark tagging, remember, these aren't whales that have to come to the surface and
right.
breathe air so that you can see them, their flukes.
Mm-hmm.
These are sharks, the majority of which spend the majority, if not all of their life, underwater.
And why are great whites so much at the surface? Because they want the big stuff that's up there to eat?
That's their feeding behavior. White sharks are very interesting because they feed, particularly as adults, not as juveniles. As juveniles, they're feeding on other sharks and other fishes on the bottom. But as adults, once they reach, 10 to 12 foot in length, not mating-age adults, but when they're no longer on the bottom as juveniles, they feed at the surface on seals and sea lions and an occasional surfer. And they do that by stalking their prey and then mugging their prey. That is, they rush up to the surface, grab their prey when their prey is unaware of them coming, take one massive bite, attempt to immobilize it so that the prey item will then bleed to death, exsanguinate, so that they can then consume it at leisure. There is a period of time after one is bitten by a white shark when there is a high probability that you will survive, particularly if you're in the water with somebody else.
Who's going to help you get out of there?
They're going to help you get out of there. You're going to be bitten in the legs or the thighs. Usually you're wearing a wetsuit. White sharks live in cool water.
Mm-hmm.
So the vast majority of victims that are involved with white shark encounters survive. About 1 out of 10 doesn't.
You were talking about what the Monterey Bay Aquarium had learned. I was out there just a week or 10 days ago. What a magnificent aquarium. But what did they learn about the daily diet of an adult great white shark? What volume?
They eat considerably more than we realize, and as the shark itself is growing, it is eating, a matter of, I'm trying to remember the kilos per fish per body weight, but considerably more than we realized, and they ate on a regular basis. These are fast-growing juveniles, however, and so we don't know how often the adults eat. We watched adults in the field and saw that they go through periods where they don't feed at all and then periods where they would eat, a 300 to 400 pound elephant seal in one meal or scavenge on a floating whale carcass. So they eat as much as they can when they can. Their food is not that available year-round.
Michael Scholl, can you tell by the fin itself, the health? Can you get a sense of the health of a shark or not? Is there such a thing as a healthy-looking fin and an unhealthy-looking fin?
No, I'm afraid not.
We saw with killer whales in captivity that dorsal fin sort of tips over and becomes floppy. That doesn't look so swell, but not so with great whites, huh?
No, I've never. No, you can't tell. I guess nature takes care of its own, and a shark that's weak or so will quickly be eaten by other sharks probably.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about counting sharks, great white sharks. People are, of course, repelled and scared. They're also drawn to them. Last week, California surfer Chuck Patterson made headlines when he jumped into the water deliberately to take video footage of two great whites trailing his surfboard. Here's the incident being discussed on CBS Early Show on Friday.
Almost everyone I know, and probably everyone you know, would have the same reaction if they saw a shark. You'd go the other way. You wouldn't go back for more. But not paddling surfer Chuck Patterson. He saw two sharks on Monday around him, gets out of the water. Next step, he gets his camera and goes back. And that's how he captured this dramatic footage. This is a pair of great white sharks that he actually shot.
You would not have to get in the water with the sharks to participate in the plan Michael Scholl is trying to put together to have people, digitally submit photographs from around the world of great white fins above water, as they so often are, to try and put together a kind of database. There are lots of ways of tracking what's going on with sharks out there. John McCosker has done a lot of it. He joins us from Marin County, California today. Senior scientist, chair of the Department of Aquatic Biology at the California Academy of Sciences. And right now, off the coast of Southern California, Christopher Lowe joins us. He's director of the Shark Lab at California State University, Long Beach. He joins us from a boat off the coast of Southern California, where he is tagging juvenile great whites. Christopher Lowe, thank you very much for being with us.
Hi, Tom.
What are you seeing this morning? And do you have any young great whites out there in your sights?
Not yet, but it's still early.
What's the likelihood? How many might you hope to see in one, day's sail, Christopher?
Well, it depends. Along the coast, there seems to be areas or pockets where people see them more often. There are areas down off San Onofre, where the surfer recently videotaped the sharks. There are also locations in Santa Monica Bay up by Malibu. These are areas where people tend to see the small ones quite regularly in the summer.
Do you attempt to draw them to you by using chum or some other way?
No, quite often they're right near the surface. They'll come right near the boat. So it usually depends on conditions. If it's nice and flat and calm, the animals will actually swim right up to the boat. It makes it easy.
How do you attach a tag? And what kind of tag are you looking to put on?
Well, we've collaborated with Monterey Bay Aquarium, and usually what happens is if commercial fishers accidentally catch a shark in their nets, call us, we'll come out. Usually my graduate students will come out, and they'll assess the shark, and the shark looks good. We'll put a satellite transmitter on it, and we'll let the shark go.
Now,
that's how we know that a majority of the sharks that the fishers catch actually get released alive and do quite well.
So the fishermen are that willing to cooperate. They'll take the extra effort to, keep the shark in the water in a net until one of your guys gets out there?
Yeah, absolutely. And one of the things that we've learned that was very surprising is how hardy these little baby white sharks are.
They can put up with that net time until you get there. When you put in the tag, where does it go? How's it attached exactly? How long does it stay on?
The satellite transmitters that we put on the animals gets attached externally, and these actually can stay on for periods, depending on how long we program them, to about 6 months. And at a program date, these will pop off, float to the surface, and then send us information back via satellite.
Well, now, why is that necessary? If sharks are so often at the surface, why can't you just leave it on the animal perpetually?
Well, we have used fixed fin tags. These get attached to the dorsal fin. And the problem with satellite transmission is they only work in air. So the animal has to be at the surface for the satellite transmission to work. So we use two types of satellite tags, ones that get attached to the fins that are designed to fall off after a period of time, and then others that are designed to pop off and float to the surface. So the ones that pop off and float to the surface tell us a lot about the and the temperature of the water that the animal's going through, but it doesn't give us very accurate information about where they are in terms of their position. The ones attached to their fins, however, when the shark's at the surface, it gives us a pretty accurate location of where the shark is. So using the combination of these two types of transmitters, baby sharks that are found in Southern California, caught in this area during the summer, stay here during the summer months. But as soon as the water starts getting cold, and they swim down towards Baja. They're not stupid. They swim down to warm water.
We hear your radio traffic on the boat there. Do you tag adult great whites as well, Christopher, or not?
No, we haven't. Because most of the animals that we see in our neck of the woods interact with are these baby white sharks. And they're in quite often quite close to shore. They can get within a mile of shore or even closer, just outside the surf zone.
Well, we've got a little air there from off the coast of Southern California where Christopher Lowe is on his boat. I hope we can get Christopher back. Christopher, hang with us if you can. Let me get a call right here. Chris calling from Boston. Chris, you're on the air.
Hi, guys. How you doing?
Pretty well. What do you know?
So So I used to work in Chatham actually in the early 90s in the fishing business, and it was interesting because when we during that time down there, the seal population was just starting to come back.
Mm-hmm.
And over the years, we saw the seal population grow and grow and grow. We always said, you know, I wonder if the sharks are going to show up at some point and start eating these things.
Right there on the elbow of Cape Cod, where indeed they have come back.
Right. Yeah, no, and now I'm up here in Boston not working in that business anymore, but it's great to kind of read and see all about the great whites there. And I was just, it was just an interesting see the direct correlation between that population grow and the seals, that, you know, the sharks actually do come back. And I was wondering if that population of sharks, if your researchers knew if that was a population that was there, you know, way back when there were maybe more seals there.
That's interesting.
Before that population crashed.
Yeah, John McCosker, what about the relationship between seals and shark populations? And if one crashes and goes away for a while, when it returns, would it be the same gang of great whites one way or another, or do you have any idea?
Yeah, I have an idea, not based on my own work there, but that of others, and that is that fortunately not every last shark in that part of the ocean was killed, and the few that might have survived, even though there weren't seals available, are now returning. There's some strain that goes on with the population, so if there is an available food source, you know that nature abhors a vacuum, and they'll be in there feeding upon them. I'd like to get Chris's thoughts and also any other fisher in the audience, and
yeah,
that is the fishermen are very sophisticated. They get it, and they realize that although a white shark is a big fish that can damage their nets and even involve themselves with human beings on a swimming beach, they want them alive, not dead. The reason being that they're controlling the numbers of seals and sea lions in a natural balance. And the more seals and more sea lions, the less fish there are for a fisherman to catch.
Ah.
The fishermen realize that if you get a white shark in your net, get it out of the net, hope it lives, hope it will eat the seals and sea lions that they're in competition with.
That is an interesting observation. I hadn't thought of it. Fishermen, let us know if that's your view of great whites. 800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. Christopher Lowe off the coast of Southern California, you're quoted in the press saying that you think there are more great whites than there used to be. What about fishermen in that sense? Are fishermen helping these days, or you know, an awful lot of fishermen are still finning somewhere in the world?
Yeah, so we have some evidence that suggests that since the fisheries have been reduced and white sharks have been protected since 1994, that the populations have come back. And we have some evidence based on the rates at which the few fishers that are left that are fishing are accidentally catching these baby white sharks. And since most of these animals are being released alive, in other words, there's no longer a market for them because they're protected in California, that we think that the population may be going up. And that's exactly what you'd expect to see with the kind of protection that's been put in place for white sharks in California in federal waters.
Michael Scholl in Switzerland, you know, the great white is listed as a globally threatened species by the International Union for Conservation of Nature. Is that still a fair characterization, globally threatened? They're seeing, Christopher Lowe thinks, some kind of comeback on the California coast.
Well, if there is a comeback, I'm really happy, but I'm very cautious about this because, you know, you have to realize what we discussed before, that white sharks, you know, there's a difference between males and females, but you can probably say that it takes 10 to 20 years, 10 to 15 for males and 15 to 20 years for females to get sexually mature. So considering that in South Africa, where white sharks have been protected the longest since 91,
mm-hmm.
That's not even, you know, 20 years. It's not even a generation time. So it takes a very long time for those populations to actually grow back. And in South Africa, where they're protected, there are dozens of white sharks that are killed in nets that protect beaches. There are dozens of white sharks that are killed by fishermen by mistake because they get caught in the nets. And once they get caught in nets, often, you know, white sharks, they need to swim in order to get sufficient oxygen
right
through their gills.
Mm-hmm.
So they're really quite a large number of sharks that are killed every year despite the regulations. So I didn't see any, you know, any population growing, but I'm hoping. It would be fantastic to know that somewhere that off the coast of California, the shark population is catching up.
Christopher Lowe, I know you're hanging on the radio there with the whole ocean to survey. I don't want to keep you too long. Are you optimistic or still concerned about great white populations off the U.S. West Coast?
Well, I am optimistic, and I think this is a good success story. It kind of goes to show that if we put our minds to protecting a species, even one that has occasional negative interactions with people, that we can actually protect them. Their populations can come back. And that people do care. So I think this is a good sign. And it's also a good sign that we're seeing what we're starting to expect to see in terms of ecosystem recovery. So, for example, you know, marine mammals have been protected since the 70s in U.S. waters. And now populations like the California sea lion have come back better than anybody ever expected. But now we need apex predators to help keep their populations in control. So protecting white sharks and marine mammals, that's a good sign.
Christopher Lowe, off the coast of Southern California, tagging juvenile great whites today, director of the Shark Lab at California State University, Long Beach. Thank you very much for being with us, Professor Lowe.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Let's go to Eric in Reading, Massachusetts. Eric, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Hi. I'm a recreational fisherman, and I go out to Nantucket a couple times every year. And we've seen that the seal population has decimated one of the great fisheries out there, Great Point. And we welcome the great white because the seal population, it's getting dangerous. The seals will go after the fish that are caught, and we're seeing that the seals are starting to actually come up on land and start to interact with the fishermen.
Wow.
We're getting to a point where we're going to start seeing, you know, actual attacks from seals. Who see the fish that come up as an easy meal and the humans as a predator. So we're welcoming these sharks.
You're saying bring on the apex predator, please. Maybe are you heartened this summer by what you've seen off Cape Cod, Eric?
When you protect an animal and you start to see a glut come up, it something has to call the herd. There has to be an equilibrium. I understand why we had to protect the seals, but there also has to be something to keep them in check.
Eric, I appreciate your call, sort of confirming what our experts are saying here today. Carla in New York, Katyville, New York. Carla, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I spotted a great white in Nova Scotia on Cape Breton about 10 years ago, and I was surprised to see it there in June because the North Atlantic's so cold. I thought I remembered reading at the time that great whites are able to control their body temps. Do I remember that right?
Let's put it to John McCosker. John, body temperature in great whites?
Yeah, they certainly are. I jokingly used to say that white sharks aren't cold-blooded killers. They're warm-bodied killers. They are able to control their body temperature, not as you and I do with a little furnace inside of ourselves at 98.6, but rather they can elevate their body temperature. A shark is robust as a great white shark, or as robust as a bluefin tuna, generates heat when they swim. That heat either is dissipated to the water or is recaptured before it's released to the water. And through some anatomical jury-rigging, white sharks have come up with a mechanism of capturing the heat they generate when they swim.
Wow.
And thereby elevating their stomach temperature so they can digest more rapidly, and the muscle temperature so that their muscles operate better in cold water.
Is that literally heat from friction with the water they're passing through then?
No, it's actually just a contraction of muscles.
I see.
You and I heat up a little when we do a 100-yard dash,
a
lot.
Yep.
And a white shark does the same with its internal body musculature.
Wow, that's incredible. Another, Marianne, Northfield, Massachusetts. Marianne, you're on the air.
Great, thanks for taking my call. I just finished reading a book called Paradise Found by Stephen Nichols, and he talks a lot about what the populations all over the world were, both on land and in the water, and how all these populations have fallen off or gone extinct because of, you know, overuse or overkilling. And I guess I'm worried about the sharks. You had detailed that we're killing 70 million a year. Is there anything to populate, you know, make that information known so we can stop killing so many of these animals so that they do survive?
It's a great question. Our time is short, Marianne. John McCosker, how about it? I mean, that's a lot of fins into soup bowls, but of course people don't have to eat shark's fin. Do you see
absolutely not.
Any
Let me
effort?
Just quickly say that we're trying very hard in America to make it illegal to sell it in any location in America. It's illegal for a fisherman to sell it, but you can still buy it in a market here in downtown San Francisco or in a restaurant. It shouldn't happen. The problem is that worldwide there are 200-mile limits, and what goes on in the open ocean is under no control whatsoever. It is a tragedy, and there are many websites. Just Google shark finning, and you'll see that there are organizations trying very hard, both here and even in China, to stop shark finning.
And what about Christopher Lowe's optimism that he sees a kind of great white comeback off the California coast? Globally, do you see a trend one direction or another, John?
Yes, I would suggest that globally there are local extinctions and local reductions, but it is returning somewhat as long as the food items are returning. But when you realize that the monk seal of the Caribbean is gone, that the white sharks used to eat, and the monk seal of the Hawaiian Islands is for the most part gone, it is slightly coming back. There is a chance that white sharks will recover. It's the other shark species that I'm worried about, and they don't have organizations or radio programs talking about the problems that they face.
Well, here's for them all. John McCosker at the California Academy of Science, a senior scientist, chair of the Department of Aquatic Biology there. John, thank you so much for joining us from California today.
My pleasure.
Michael Scholl in Switzerland, we're going to be looking for your project. I keep looking at this collection of fins, and it really is fascinating to think that we could have thousands and thousands up there like faces is quite something. When do you hope to open your doors and really start accepting photos in a large number, Michael?
Well, we're hoping that within 2 years we'll get the software going, and shortly afterwards it will be on the air.
I bet they'll come rolling in those photos when you do. Michael Scholl with the White Shark Trust joining us today from Lausanne, Switzerland. Thank you so much, Michael, for your work.
Thank you very much for having me.
Listeners, thanks for joining us today. I'm Tom Ashbrook. Safe swimming. This is On Point.